can survive if I let you.
Conquering nevermore.
Let the new era begin. The era of the ECW.
Oh my god.
Greetings, ECW fans, and welcome to This Is Extreme, the ECW History Podcast. I am your host, Dave Dynasty. Thank you for joining us for another fun episode. This episode, we have John Lister on. He is the author of the book, Turning the Tables, The Story of Extreme Championship Wrestling, Unauthorized and Uncensored. It is the first, to my knowledge, the first book published about ECW. It's a fun book, a fun read. I highly advise you to go pick up a copy. But I had a nice chat with John talking about the book, talking about his process, talking about how the project came to be, and then just talking some general memories of ECW in general. John made some trips, right? He's from the UK. He did make some trips to the US. He has, you know, he attended the ECW arena. He has done some things, and we talk all about those. Before we get into that, make sure you follow me and the podcast on social media. You can follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Just look up ECW Pod. Once again, the X account is still locked. I don't know. I think it's gone. I think it's lost. So what you can do is on X, follow me at the Dave Dynasty. I still will make all those posts there on my account. So follow us there. Make sure you go and get the This Is Extreme shirt. Just go to tinyurl.com/ECW pod shirt and buy one of those and support the show. Whatever podcast platform that you choose to listen to your shows on, please make sure you subscribe to us there. And if the option is available, make sure you give us a rating and a review, because that helps us in those algorithms. When other people are listening to shows, we come up as a suggested listen. Okay, let's take a really, really quick break here. Let's get right down to it. Come back with my discussion with John Lister. So stick around. Be sure to follow This Is Extreme on all social media platforms. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for ECW Pod. Be sure to follow us, keep up to date, and join in the discussions. We want to hear your feedback. So find us on all the social media platforms and join the revolution. This is
Extreme. And welcome back to This is Extreme. At this time, I am being joined by author John Lister, who wrote the book, Turning the Tables, The Story of Extreme Championship Wrestling. John, how are you?
I'm doing very well, and thanks very much for having me here.
Absolutely, absolutely. So obviously, as people might be able to tell, you're from the UK, correct?
That's right, yes. With ECW is very much even more of an underground thing here than it was in the States at the time. But the tape trading community was big fans of it. And also Power Slam magazine, which was a newsstand wrestling magazine here. Always looking out for sort of colour photos for stories. And they struck gold with a guy called George Tejinos, who was based in New Jersey and regularly used to go into the ECW arena shows and would have a client in the UK who was very glad to use his photos. And of course, being ECW, they tended to be quite dramatic, eye-catching photos.
So is that how you first, discovered, noticed ECW? Was it the magazines?
Yeah, I was also through the tape trading scene as well. This was the mid-90s, and ECW was sort of very popular. And I was lucky enough to live quite close to one of the main tape traders in the UK, a guy called Rob Butcher. And I was at university at the time, and in the UK, Wednesday afternoons at universities, there's always no lectures or sort of seminars or anything, because it's kept free. The idea is you're meant to go and play sports and take part in athletic events. So my athletic event was going around Rob's house and watching the latest ECW tape every Wednesday afternoon.
Oh, that's, athletics by osmosis. It works. So tell me, were you already a wrestling fan at this time?
Yeah, so I was a wrestling fan. I'd watched it on and off from the kind of the mid-80s when it was the British promotions on TV over here. And then in 1989, I started watching WWF and became sort of a avid fan from there. It was kind of my parents always said it was like the fad that stuck with me. It's a bit like when the wind changes and your face stays that way. It was like, I had all fads as a kid. I was into, your war gaming, I was into soccer, football, And then, yeah, when wrestling came along, it really just kind of stuck. And, you know, it's more than 35 years later, still a fan.
Yeah, so obviously here in the States, ECW, when it really caught on and people noticed it, it really, like you said, it was kind of this underground phenom, right? Because they really had their finger on the pulse of like pop culture, you know, whether it be music or whatnot. Was that kind of the same thing in the UK? Did you feel that, hey, this is a little more representative of what the youth are into?
Yeah, and possibly even more because, you know, the music in ECW tended to be things that had been quite popular, you know, a year or two earlier. So, of course, you know, the UK in some ways being a little bit behind at that time with culture was a bit slow to spread. It tended to be very popular. So, yeah, the idea that you could tune in and actually see like real music and, you know, videos with like real music intercut with the actual music videos you recognize, that was definitely very much part of it, feeling like this is kind of aimed at adults and sort of, you know, older teenagers rather than just children, which was very much both WWF and WCW were kind of going for at the time.
Yeah, I agree. And like I said, you wrote this book, you've got other books. What's your background as a writer? Were you already writing? Is that already something you had an interest in?
Yeah, I mean, I always, as long as I can remember, wanted to be a journalist of some kind. And the first wrestling material that I wrote was for a, I guess you'd call it a fanzine, but it was not sold by mail order. It was actually sold in shops, but just in the town where we lived. So it was a few kids in the local town who were a few years older than me who were at university at the time. I was about 14. And we'd actually take it to sort of news agents and newsstands around the town we lived in and get them to sell it. And we always like to say we factually were outselling the WWF magazine, but only within a 3-mile radius.
Well, you know, I mean, however you have to spin the demographics, it works. I mean, it's funny because there was so much stuff like that with fans at that time, right? Pre-internet. And it's I always said it's, you know, kind of the same thing now. It's just you have a different avenue of delivering the product, right? It's you know, there are still people who are writing in a quote unquote fanzine fashion. They just now deliver it, whether it be a blog, a website, or a, you know, a video blog on YouTube or whatever it is. You know, people always talk about how much things change, and it's to some degree, but it's more the technology part, the delivery side, that's changed more than anything.
And I think in a way that process works in reverse, because people always say, all right, you know, wrestling fans today, all they do is say they sit on their Twitter and they have flame wars and they just get into arguments with each other. Well, we used to do that with the British fanzine things. You know, you'd make your point and somebody would argue it back and you'd argue back. The only thing was, between each person making their point, you had to wait a month for the letters to go in and appear in the next issue. So it kind of gave you a bit more time to, you know, reflect on the point you were making.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's, I remember getting in very heated discussions on, you know, on the playground or in class or whatever about, you know, who the next champion was going to be or who was going to win what match. It was the same thing. We just didn't have social media. We were doing it face to face on the playgrounds. So as a writer, right, you're, you know, like you said, writing some fanzine type things and had this interest. When did you decide that, hey, I want to write this book about the history of ECW? How did that strike you?
So after I sort of graduated from university, I worked in public relations and journalism for about 5 or 6 years, and then sort of left from there to become a freelance writer. The first thing I did after that, I was kind of had this time in my hand, so I put together a compilation of a lot of articles that I'd written for my own fanzine and sort of other magazines before, which was called Slampology, and that's also got a lot of sort of travel stories, really, of the first 3 times I went to the United States to watch wrestling, which included the first trip was to an ECW convention. After kind of getting to grips with the mechanics of publishing the book and sort of putting it together, I thought, well, I'd like to do a topic, you know, do a book completely from scratch, and thought, you know, what's something that I know a good bit about and the kind of thing that is a big enough subject to cover, you know, in a full length book, but not so big and so kind of in depth that you can't possibly sort of do it justice in a book. And also something that's going to attract the attention of kind of readers and be of interest. And this was beginning of 2005, I started writing this and finally published it, I think, in sort of the October or the November, but really kind of struck gold because right in the middle of this process was the WWF having the idea to do the one-night stand show. And of course, the alternate independent version of the Hardcore Homecoming. So that really kind of got a lot of people interested, and people sort of hadn't seen ECW but watched One Night Stand were quite interested in, you know, what's kind of the history of this. So I think that really helped the book catch on.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I can gather, what I've seen, I have quite the book library. So I looked through all this. Whatever. You were the first to publish a book about the history of ECW that I can tell.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of other books which followed on. There was the official WWF version, which was kind of the book based on the DVD, which had come out the previous year. And then there's Scott Williams put together one, which I think was published the end of 2006, because I think he covered some of the sort of WWF, the sci-fi, the bring back the weekly TV. But mine was definitely the first dedicated book on ECW to be published. And I think by being it was a self-published book, that kind of gave me the big advantage of being able to kind of get it out there kind of straight away and sort of, yeah, be first in that marketplace.
Yeah, and you mentioned, so really briefly, you mentioned Slamthology. And like you said, it talks about some of your trips to America, and one of them was ECW-related. Tell us about that trip. When was that?
So that was August of 96, and at this time, twice a year, there's a guy called Tom Misnick, who was sort of known online as Mr. ECW, who would organise an internet convention. So it would be tied in with a weekend where there'd be a sort of spot show on a Friday night and ECW in on the Saturday, and you kind of book it so you could get tickets through him, you could get reserved seats, which was something, you know, you really needed to do it at this point, because otherwise you were going to be standing at the back trying to desperately kind of fit in somewhere. And then there'd be a couple of sort of suites in the hotel that would be kind of reserved for a tape watching during the day. And then usually the Saturday would have a question and answer session with various sort of ECW roster members, you know, management. Paul Heyman, Todd Gordon would both be there. So this kind of was the first time I went over to go to these two events. I saw the sort of screenshot recently. You can see where I'm standing at one end. I'd been asked to hold up this sign, which said "Bubba must die," because at this point, this was summer of 1996. Bubba Ray Dudley was still the babyface Dudley. Devon was the recently brought in his sort of heel brother. And the fans at this point were totally fed up with the whole Dudley gimmick. They thought it was overblown. It was not going to last anymore. So they thought, if you hold up this sign, it's going to get the message through, and that will be the end of the thing. I think, of course, what actually happened was they took that as a sign, we need to turn Bubba a heel because the fans don't like him. And it's probably fair to say that extended the longevity of the gimmick quite a bit.
Yeah.
But the other end of this sign, holding up this sign, is Brian Last, who's now Jim Cornette's partner. And somebody recently pointed out to us, sort of, two seats in front of there is a 13 or 14-year-old Tony Khan.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask him that when you brought that up, because I've heard Brian Last tell that story about the Bubba Must Die, the big, what was it? Was it a bed sheet? Or it was very large, right?
Yeah, it was literally literally a bed sheet. I don't know, you know, couldn't say for certain. It was acquired from the hotel the convention was at, but yeah, that was it.
Yeah, that's funny. I've heard him tell that story, and so you were opposite end, right? Was that just by happen chance where you were? Had you met Brian at this convention?
No, I actually didn't know about this until I did a podcast with Brian, possibly 15 years or so later. And happened to, you know, mention this and realize that it was, you know, his sign. We just happened to be far enough along to help hold it up. Because luckily we knew through George Tejinos, we were able to get into the building earlier than kind of the people who'd been bussed over for the convention, which meant we were able to get seats at the back row of the bleachers, which was great viewing experience. So you had to be there, you know, hours early to get those spots. It was potentially quite dangerous when the wrestlers were brawling in the crowd, because there was a good chance you were going to have to jump off the back, and it was, you know, 6 feet or so down. So you had to be quite careful. But yeah, it was an amazing experience. I think the thing that always struck me was that you were there having been in the afternoon, you'd had both Shane Douglas and separately the Pit Bulls talking about the injury to one of the Pit Bulls, which had just happened the show earlier. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about, you know, how, you know, it obviously is an accident, how bad it is when kind of things happen. And it's like something you sort of think to yourself, do we work this into the storyline? And then kind of you go to the show and, you know, the doors aren't officially open, but a lot of the fans are kind of already in there. And there's wrestlers in the ring, you know, working out, and people who'd been in a match the day before were sort of in there, you know, shaking hands, talking to each other, working through spots in front of quite a lot of the fans. And you think this is like, this is breaking every rule there is. But then during the show, when they had Shane Douglas against the Pitbull 1, who was, or Pitbull 2 rather, whose partner had been, you know, severely injured and was in this neck race, it was the most genuinely heated match I'd ever seen. It was just the amazing ability, and I think the realization of going to ECW Live was that a lot of what you thought of, there's no baby faces and heels, and the crowds, you know, they're just like, they're not into supporting one side or the other, was just complete nonsense. You know, nearly every match was some form of babyface heel, and the crowd were, even if it was, you know, deliberately suspending disbelief, they were really willing to kind of get caught up with it and generally sort of, you know, live or die by whether the babyfaces won.
Yeah, I've always said, I mean, obviously ECW is so influential for so many ways, but one of the things is they were the kind of the first to embrace the smart fan, right? They knew, hey, this is, like it or not, this is here. This is what it is. These people, you know, these fans are, they're informed that they live and die for this stuff. So they said, let's use it. And they would, you know, they would at times attempt to work the smart fan and sometimes would do it. And, but they, like I said, they embraced that. And I think that's one of the more trend setting things they did for wrestling is to realize, hey, this is happening. This is only going to get bigger and worse. Whether we like it or not, let's accept it and use it.
I think, again, it was this really interesting kind of crossover period because, as you say, they were kind of a harbinger of a lot of the future of the style of wrestling, the style of appealing to the fans. Mm-hmm. Certainly the, you know, anytime you see people about, you know, I'm a WWE loyalist, you know, I hate AEW, or I'm an AEW loyalist, I hate TNA. I think ECW really was the first kind of promotion where the idea was, you know, you would be a fan of the brand, a fan of the promotion as much as of any individual wrestler. And kind of there was this, you know, the biggest feud in ECW was ECW against the WWF and the WCW.
Yep.
You know, even when they may have actually been working together behind the scenes in many ways. But I always likened it to getting onto pay-per-view was ECW winning the world title. And you had the thing of what do you do when you have a world title, and a lot of guys kind of lose steam. I think in a way that happened to ECW. But then going back, in a way, they were the last of the old territory system. So it was, yep, particularly at the arena, it was around about 1,000 or so in this building every 3 weeks running regularly. So you were still having to use a lot of the old kind of promotional tactics and approaches of keeping the crowd there, kind of building up from show to show, having the storylines, you know, wanting to give the crowd something satisfied so they can stay invested, but not giving them so much, you know, not beating all the heels all the time so there's no interest in coming back. And it's kind of really that crossover of, I feel like, you know, Smoky Mountain, which ended at the end of 95, was like the last full-time territory. Mm-hmm. And then ECW was kind of like really that bridge between the territory independent scene and kind of, you know, the future of not necessarily being based entirely in a particular area, but kind of appealing to fans around the world and being a sort of, you know, a third national promotion in a way.
Yeah, that makes sense. And like I said, I've talked to Todd Gordon and some others, and they, you know, Todd has kind of held to the fact that, you know, when they started to overstep, that was kind of the first step to the end, right? When they tried to, you know, it's like financially tried to expand into Florida and on the Sunshine Network and different things like that. While yes, it seemed great, you know, there was a lot of money going out without, you know, so much coming back, right? Without the return. And then, you know, even pay-per-view, as great as it sounds, he always said, hey, I don't know if we're ready for that. And it was almost like you always hear ECW was, they were, you know, too big to be small and not, you know, too small to be big. And they were caught in this weird thing and kind of a victim of their own circumstance. I mean, do you feel that's true?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of concluded at the end of the book, really, after going through kind of all of the business aspects of it, really, that basically once you go past the point of, you know, a small indie, which is we can draw what we can, you know, it'll be a few hundred fans, we'll draw however many hundreds or thousands of dollars we get, and then our job is to make sure we spend less than that so that we make a profit in the same business. Once you get past that and you get start growing, I think really basically they were dead and it was just a case of, you know, when it would happen. And really it's not so much a case of whether they were in the long run profitable or making a loss. It was about the cash flow that eventually kind of did for them and kind of decided when they got to the point where it got out of hand. Because as they kept growing, they had to keep growing. There was always, you know, some step they would have to take. They would have to run more shows so they could afford to give people more time, more work, so that they could not have to go and, you know, work a part-time job, or eventually had to start getting onto pay-per-view to keep people from going to WWF and WCW and getting the full-time contracts there. And then you had to go to national TV to get the money there, to get the exposure, to get the sponsorship deals. And the problem was, every step in this case, the money you had to spend out was going out straight away. Money coming in for it was coming down the line. And you kind of got to the case, I think eventually was the TNN deal, which was, you know, nowadays you get a TV deal, you're getting paid for it, you're golden. At this point, it was such a terrible deal that they had to sign because it was the only way they could keep expanding. But they would have to have had to dramatically increase like their live business and their sponsorship money, which they did increase it a lot, but it was never at the rate to catch up. And the same with the pay-per-view, there's so many upfront costs, and a lot of the time for a smaller company on pay-per-view at the time, the problem would be you'd be getting, say, a 50-50 split, but how it would work would be the first 50,000 buys, all the money would go to the pay-per-view companies. You know, for the next 50,000, you were getting all that money. And then once you were on over 100,000, you were just getting a 50% of the money. So the problem was, until you kind of, A, reached that level of buys, and B, they'd all been counted and, you know, you confirmed we have got this total of more than this amount of money. So it's your turn to start getting your share of the money. That's an absolute killer for cash flow. And of course, the fact that it's no secret that the, you know, for behind the scenes accounting was not quite at the professional level it should have been.
Yeah.
You've got kind of, you know, the very much the Jim Crockett kind of thing where by the time you realize, you know, you need to cut back on the money, it's kind of too late.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm always fascinated about the process of historians and writers. And like I said, you've written several books. So when you commit to a project such as a CCW book, so where do you start? What is your first step and working on this project?
So with this one, this is probably not how I would do it today, but I kind of realized quite early it was not going to be practical in 2005 to be a book kind of based around interviews, which was primarily because at that point, being the base in the UK, there were sort of the time zone differences, but you didn't have your Skype or your Zooms and things, so it would have been entirely on phone calls and just, and that wouldn't have been financially practical. Plus, at the time, I guess maybe there's kind of thing of, you know, I don't want to interview people and kind of have them lie to me. And also, it was still really the later kind of period of the time of, you know, wrestlers don't talk openly to kind of journalists. Still, you know, Foley's book was still only a few years old. So the idea of kind of wrestling books being kind of respectable and, you know, serious books rather than kind of like completely in storyline wasn't there. So I kind of went about it of, I think I spent about 6 weeks of, let's just gather together every piece of information I can about ECW from as many sources as I can, whether it's, you know, newsletters from the time, reports, whether it's from tapes, whether it's some kind of shoot interviews. And then there's a lot of filtering out of, you know, can I trust this particular source, you know, what they're saying here. And think, one really good thing there is either if you're talking to them, ask questions, or if you're kind of looking at somebody else's interview, kind of look through for things that you know factually, check that they're sort of saying the right things there, so that you know that they're generally being honest. And then, like, things that you don't know but you're kind of taking it on their word, you can be more trustworthy about. And then it's kind of, you know, are you getting multiple sources kind of confirming the same thing? And then it was more kind of working out how am I going to kind of arrange this. And it's kind of it's not going to be just a straight chronology, so it's going to be kind of half moving through the time periods, but also kind of organizing things kind of logically into, you know, starting off looking at what made Philadelphia so special, and then kind of looking at kind of the expansion of the TV network. And kind of I kind of then found, not intentionally, but it just made sense, but pretty much the first half of the book is much more about the in-ring product, kind of expansion, the how they appeal to the fans, with like a little bit about the business. And once you get to about Barely Legal, which is kind of the midpoint of the book, after that, the in-ring becomes kind of less of a focus, and it's much more about the business sphere. They're actually trying to become sort of a full-time national promotion. And then it's going to say, looking through for a few spots to kind of break up the sort of chronological narrative. And kind of there's one chapter where I just focus entirely on the Raven Dreamer feud, and kind of look through kind of how that was booked, and then be like a little bit to just break up where it's just like some classic Joel Gertner of the offensive lines, which was the one chapter I really hope my mother didn't read when she had a look through the book.
Yeah.
And then from there, it's just a case of going over to, you know, many, many rewrites and re-edits to kind of get it as tight as possible. Because with the publisher that I was using, the book was printed on demand, so the cost was going to be very dependent on the page count. So I had to sort of get it in at a tight page count while still being as comprehensive and not missing anything important out, but not having too much fluff.
Yeah, with a lot of the research that I've done, I'm a bit obsessive, right? I want the thoroughness. I want to know everything. And one thing I've always struggled to do is to know when to stop, right? When to just say, that's either lost the time, there's just no information there, nothing I can fill this hole with. It is what it is. I've always struggled with that fear of, okay, if you move on, something will come out and you'll miss it or whatever. How do you know when to do that? When you're researching something or gathering information, whether it be like maybe a specific topic for the book, to know when just to say, okay, that's it. I've got what I can get. You know, this is good. How is there a way that you know when to say, okay, this is it, stop here?
I think it's really kind of when you think, so how would I boil down and explain this to somebody? And when you get to a point where you've got too much information to be able to still be able to boil it down to kind of what are the most important points, what's kind of the lesson and the trend here. I think ECW made a good topic for a book like that, because, as I say, it's big enough to be covered in the length of the book, but it's also something that it was largely, you know, completely documented. So pretty much every ECW result from every show is out there, has been recorded by people at the time, whether through the newsletters or through websites later, which meant you could look through and say, you know, genuinely see how many shows they were running at different times, you know, how long people were in for, what kind of patterns there were in kind of the booking and the business. And I think that made it kind of quite manageable, in contrast to, you know, if you tried to do the history of the WWF the same way, you would have, you know, thousands and thousands of shows. You wouldn't know where to start. And then going back, you get to a point where there's things that, you know, just aren't documented, because particularly when it's not a kind of a mainstream media kind of topic. So you really, I think it's just kind of keeping that focus of remembering that you're telling a story, and kind of every fact that you put in a book has to be there to kind of support the argument, to make the point, to kind of illustrate the big story, rather than it just turning into, you know, this happened, then this happened, then this happened, and you kind of read through and it's like, you've given me a lot of information, but I've not really kind of had a message, I've not really kind of learned anything from this.
Yeah. On the back of the book, you say that you discovered a little-known truth about one of the most famous ECW feuds. I'm assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong, that we're speaking of the Raven Dreamer feud.
That's great. Yeah. So and that's really a good example, I think, of one of the things that I found most useful of going back through old reports, old newsletter articles, that there was a lot of information that, you know, that piece was known at the time. It was, you know, not secret. But when you go back and you look at it in the context of knowing what came later, you realize, you know, oh, these things fitting together, these were quite interesting. This may have influenced something going on. A lot of that was to do with kind of the business side. But yeah, it was finding out that a couple of months into the feud, that Tommy Dreamer actually won a clean pinfall over Raven on a spot show. And that was just like, and obviously that was at a time when they hadn't kind of realized that they had this story of Raven, you know, Tommy is never going to pin Raven until the very end of the feud. And they both wish it had never happened. You know, I think Tommy Dreamer would be like, he would never, ever pin him. Ever, because he probably knew he was going to come back at some point. And of course, it's something that is so easy to overlook, because obviously you never mention it on TV. Mm-hmm. At this point, it's still, internet wrestling is still very much in its infancy.
Right.
And at the time it happened, the fans that went to that show wouldn't realize that that would be significant. So it wouldn't be like if you were, you know, 6 months into this feud and you're being told every week on TV, Raven never beats Dreamer. And they thought, well, we can just get away with it. You know, Mountaintop Madness in Jimport, Pennsylvania, will have Tommy Dreamer win because nobody will find out. Because had at that point, somebody would have gone straight online and went, oh my God, you know, Tommy won this thing last night. And today there'd be, you know, clips on the internet in 20 seconds. Whereas at this point, it's just kind of, you know, lost to kind of the footnotes of old show results. And I remember I was always like desperately trying to kind of get confirmation of this. And I know I was really, really pleased when I managed to track down a recording of the show and confirm that, you know, it wasn't a misprint or somebody misremembered the result. But no, that is how it happened.
Yeah, that's very old school, right? That's the whole, you know, Andre's undefeated or Andre's never been slammed or all these different things that when you watch TV, you know, wrestling on TV, you just took it at its word because you didn't know any different, right? You didn't know, you know, what happened in the territories, you know, pre-TV, pre-internet. So that is fascinating.
It's also, it's kind of an interesting subject of ECW because I think it's probably the first promotion of that size that was running as eventually a full-time operation, kind of a place where people wrestled full-time, where certainly once you get to about 95, 96, with the deal with Rob Feinstein at RF Video, it's one of the very few promotions where pretty much every ECW match or every spot show was recorded, is on video, exists in video form. Of course, now, you know, AEW, every moment of AEW is available on tape. There was like kind of one house show that wasn't recorded. They clearly recorded it themselves. People took lots of clips. But if you go back, you think how many thousands of, you know, WWF matches or like, you know, Smoky Mountain, I guess, record a lot of shows. But the idea that like every match would actually be there and you could go back and kind of see, and a lot of people have, you know, went back and watched a lot of the house shows. I mean, you'll get things where you get a different perspective on it. So you'll get people who have looked for all the shows in sort of 99, 2000. And the memory of everyone at the time is that just incredible being kind of a long-term champion was, you know, ridiculous idea of, you know, the classic sign that the promotion is dying. And people who've been kind of seen it all in the context saying how, you know, they were kind of really enjoyed his run on the house shows as the champion that he was having, you know, credible, so to speak, you know, main event matches.
Yeah. So mentioning in that same vein, when you did the research, when you went back and looked through this stuff, and as you were writing, is there someone in the, like that instance where you gained a whole new appreciation that maybe before you weren't necessarily a fan of, necessarily understood their value to the company, but is there someone maybe that jumped out of, hey, I kind of overlooked that as a fan watching ECW and he was pretty impactful?
I'm not sure anyone really stands out because, you know, certainly up to about 1997, I was so avidly, you know, a viewer of the tapes. And a couple of times, me and a friend, my parents had gone away. We were sort of teenagers at the time. We were left at the house myself for a few days. Now, this is where, you know, American high school video movies tell you that this is where you have a big wild, you know, keg party, you invite loads of women over. Of course, what we did was sit down and watch 48 hours of ECW TV in one weekend, which I don't recommend because, yeah, you end up kind of suspending your disbelief just through, you know, losing any rational sleep and rational ability to see your own mind. And, you know, you see the same commercials 20 times an hour for 48 hours is quite a crazy thing. But yeah, so I think I kind of already had kind of a good idea of some people. Maybe kind of the people like, you know, the Juventud and the Rey Mysterio as to how they kind of really, their stuff stands up. And, you know, a lot of the matches are not designed to stand up over time because they were designed to be sort of kind of great stuff at the time. And what more I think really holds up is the TV, not so much, you know, in ring quality or because it's, you know, because it's got the violence or because it's got the music, but the fact that the ECW TV, the original, before CNN syndicated show, was a different format every week. And you're so used now to, you know, you can take pretty much any episode of Raw or SmackDown from the last 15 years. And it's going to be, you know, it may have a different set, it may have different colors, may have different announcers, but the basic concept of the show, that it's 2 hours, it's presented either live or recorded as live. It's a 2 hour continuous, kind of show. It's a matches, in-ring promos, backstage promos, matches, in-ring promos, always, you know, a main event at the end of the show. Very much kind of the same concept. You know, the ECW TV would be completely different every week. You know, some weeks it would be, you know, an entire show long match. Some weeks it would be sort of a clip show. You might have 1 week it would be from 3 different events kind of packaged together. And obviously, in hindsight, you realize a lot of that was to do with they went and recorded with stuff, you know, how good quality is it? Is it going to work in its kind of unedited form? You know, are we going to have to cut it down to a 3-minute music video and make the Eliminators look like the greatest team in the history of wrestling? Or, you know, is it going to be like a Guerrero Malenko where we're going to make the whole show built around them, start off with interviews with them, show their final match, show the post-match scenes and kind of make that a show. And it's just, you know, you never knew what you were going to get and it wasn't predictable.
Yeah, I've been watching quite a bit of like 97, 98 ECW, and two things that have jumped at me is the just incredible, like you mentioned. And while later, you know, when he was shot, I remember at the time thinking, why is this guy champ? I don't get just incredible. But then when I go back and watch this 97, 98, from the moment he came in, man, they were pushing the hell out of him. He was, you know, he was injuring guys, you know, and winning virtually everything. He was all over the TV. You know, and so it's like they really saw potential in him, I guess, you know, building him right from the get-go. So there's that. And then I forgot how over at that period Al Snow had gotten with the whole head thing. And, or at least how much they portrayed it on TV and made us feel that. I mean, obviously the crowd, you responded, but it's remarkable. I just forgot that, right? I remember, you know, Al Snow in WWE with the head thing and thinking, okay, whatever. But man, it really caught on in ECW more than I recalled.
Yeah, I remember thinking that was kind of a sign that as they were kind of growing bigger, that the sort of the crowds and the product was changing a bit. Because obviously, I think there would be a time where if you said, you know, Al Snow's really going to get over, he's going to be a really popular star and he's going to main event a pay-per-view, you would be assuming, oh, wow, so it's going to be like 25 minutes of Al Snow and like, you know, a Shane Douglas or, you know, Taz or someone. They're going to have kind of a cross between, you know, a Japanese star and a kind of an American match star, maybe a bit of high flying. And what you actually got was a 4.5-minute match in a ring that one side of it had been taped off because it had a big hole in it from Taz and Bigelow going through it. and the entire, the other half of the ring would be entirely full of styrofoam heads, you'd start to think, okay, something's changed here. And I think that was part of the going to a bigger audience, was the get the thing that kind of gets over, that becomes familiar. People want to see kind of something familiar, and you kind of burn through it as quick as you can. You kind of, you know, at some point it's going to run its course, and like the crowd are going to get past it. But you don't drag it out. You kind of strike while the iron's hot.
Yeah, I agree. So if you were writing this same book now, beginning this project now, with the same hindsight, right, with the same knowledge that you have of what you did before, what would you do differently, right? Because you'd obviously have a lot more. You have a lot more tools now, right? Like you said, you talked about the interviews. It's so much easier, regardless of where you are, to do an interview now, to conduct an interview, just like you and I are doing now. And there's so much more access, digitized, you know, records and things online now than there was, we're talking 20 years ago. So what kind of things would you do now in doing this project?
I think so doing it now, you know, interviewing wrestlers would be very different. That's now something I've got a lot of experience from one of my other projects, and eventually turned into a book, which was writing for Fighting Spirit magazine in the UK, which is another newsstand magazine. Mm-hmm. And we'd have a monthly feature interviewing old wrestlers from the TV era in Britain, which goes up to about 1988 and goes back to the mid-50s. And that, you know, really learned a lot about interviewing there, because a lot of the times it was wrestlers who were still kind of in the mindset of, you know, you don't speak to people about the inner workings of a business. So you'd have to kind of learn a lot of skills of sounding out, kind of working out from them what you were going to get from what they were comfortable talking about. So one of the things I would always do would ask for question, when did you start to feel comfortable in the ring? Which in itself is not always going to get you, you know, a fantastic answer. It's going to be the best piece of your interview. But the way they answer that tells you kind of a lot about how they're sort of responding. So, you know, if they go, oh, well, I was really, really nervous, but I was on with, you know, Mick McMahon's the top star, and he gave me a lot. He took care of me in the ring and, you know, made me look good because he was confident he was going to win and, you know, didn't step on me. Is a very different answer to they go, oh, I was, you know, I had no problems at all. I knew I was going to win straight away. And, you know, I had a challenge from this guy, but I broke his arm and beat him in, you know, three rounds. So I knew I was great. You know, it's going to be kind of a very different, tough interview. So I think writing the book now, because this, you know, wrestling history is so well documented and, you know, so many people have told these stories, I think it would be, one way would be to let's concentrate on kind of the human aspects and kind of get the stories of the different people on it, of, you know, what did ECW mean to them? How did it affect kind of their life and their career? And, you know, how would things have been different without it? I think the other way would be kind of much more explicitly exploring how it influenced what came afterwards, how it, you know, affected kind of the online wrestling community, the brand loyalty of different promotions. Obviously, you know, the influence on Tony Khan, having been a fan going to those shows, and, you know, Paul Heyman having come in and become sort of, you know, such a big part of WWE, and really kind of interesting in what survived, what approaches survived, and what bit sort of died out and you know, isn't so influential anymore.
Yeah, so let me ask you this. As a fan, what is your favorite year of ECW, year or a couple years of ECW?
So it would be kind of a tie for two different reasons. So it would be 1995 for story, 1996 for the in-ring. 1995 was when you had... kind of, I think it was the peak of having so many different stories, but all kind of like, were kind of well booked, you know, intricate stories in their own right. But the thing with ECW, as compared to other promotions at the time, was that the storylines would intermingle. So, you know, if you were in WWF in, you know, 1995, 1996, these two wrestlers would have a beef, and for the next 3 months, they would be beating other, you know, lower wrestlers, winning squash matches, talking about how they were going to go after each other, and they would have no interaction whatsoever with the next two wrestlers who had their own beef. Whereas with ECW, it was always everything kind of merged into each other, and you'd have quite often they would do, like, the start of a show, they would start off interviewing another wrestler, somebody else would come in. As they were leaving, you know, it would bleed over into the next match. The classic example of that is the 1997 Wrestlepalooza, where you've got the Tommy Dreamer Raven match, which kind of ends with the running, I think it's from Jerry Lawler, which sets up the Sabu Taz rematch, which ends up with, you know, Shane Douglas coming out from the challenge and Taz winning it. And you've had sort of, you know, 45 straight minutes of half a dozen different feuds all merging into each other and, like, making this kind of coherent narrative. And 95 was so much of that. And the absolute classic is the Pitbulls against Raven and Richards, best of three falls, double dog collar match, which also has, you know, is Dreamer going to get his first pin on Raven? And then you've got referee Ben Alfonso, who's been, you know, causing trouble all year. And then 911 comes out, and then he's been chokeslamming everyone. He finally gets his gets to chokeslam Bill Alfonso. And it's just all these things merging together in complete chaos. And you get, I had friends at university who would borrow that tape and they'd watch it, and they'd never seen pretty much any wrestling before. And they kind of, you know, they could watch it and enjoy it just in its own merits. But if you'd been watching the TV for sort of 6 months beforehand, it was like all of these storylines kind of merging together.
Yeah, yeah. I 96 is probably my favorite year. And but I think, you know, everything holds, there's a little something there, typically, in each year. So we mentioned earlier, we talked about Slamthology earlier. You mentioned briefly the Have a Good Week Till Next Week, about the British wrestlers of the TV era. You also wrote a book called Pure Odyssey. Which was kind of about your journey to the Japan, in much in the same kind of the same like of those chapters in Slamthology. Excuse me. Do you have any plans for any more books? Is there another project on the horizon?
So nothing at the moment. I'm always kind of interested in possible topics. Looking maybe at the idea of whether I would sort of pitch something to a traditional publisher, where they would sort of, you know, pay an upfront fee to put a topic. Say Fighting Spirit magazine closed a few years ago, unfortunately. It's just the print publishing was no longer really viable with the cost of paper publishing going up, you know, the advertising market going down. At the time, WWE TV ratings were really slumping. So there was kind of the publishers have this kind of fear that it's going to affect the interest in the magazine. But yeah, kind of always kind of thinking on the topic of what would make an interesting topic for another book. So always open to ideas.
Well, very good. Hopefully we'll see some more work from you in the future. Like I said, I enjoy your books. Like I said, I've read the ECW book. I've read the British TV book. Slamthology, I have. Haven't actually read it yet, but it's one that I want to dive into. So I am a fan of your work, so hopefully we get to see more of you in the future. You mentioned that, you know, you're looking for next projects. You're always active and doing things. Is there a way that fans can follow you online? What's the easiest way for them to follow you so they can know if something does pop up or arise?
So two ways. I'm on the X, for former Twitter, as just John Lister, JohnLister. You can also check out my book review blog, which is prowrestlingbooks.com. And there's also a page on there that has a list of all my books and links to where you can buy them online. So that's, yeah, definitely the easiest way to check it out.
Yeah, well, there you go. Like I said, they're all easy to find. I believe you can pretty much most online, you know, Amazon, everything else, I think you can still find your books. I think they're all out there.
They're all on Amazon in both print and Kindle, and I believe they're all part of the Kindle One unlimited lending library, which is like sort of, you know, the Netflix of ebooks, I guess. Yeah, it is, where you can pay a monthly fee, so they're all on there. And yeah, that on that's quite interesting, because rather than a flat fee, I get paid sort of a small amount as for each page somebody reads through. So I do know that there's one person in Japan who has a copy of Slamthology, and they're obviously enjoying it, but, you know, they don't want to rush it and they're taking their time. So every month I'll get, you know, Mr. So-and-so has read another two chapters. You've got another, you know, 11 yen coming. So I, I don't know if that's going to be my pension plan, but yeah. Looking forward to it.
That is so. It's almost like you have this bond with this person in Japan that you have no idea who they are. That's it makes you wonder how's that happen? What's he doing? Where is he so busy that he just has trouble finding time? Is he just? I think
because it's Slamfology, is the first half of it is the kind of pretty epic travel experiences. So as well as the ECW trip, we came back for a couple where we went much longer trips around the States. So we went to Memphis TV in its dying days. We went to what was at the time Terry Funk's retirement show, into the Dallas Sports Auditorium. So they're quite fun. And the second half of it is a lot sort of shorter articles. I can certainly see how you read one of those at a time.
Yeah, that's intriguing. Thank you, John, for your time and coming on and talking to us about your research, your book on ECW, your fandom of ECW. Like I said, the book is called Turning the Tables, The Story of Extreme Championship Wrestling. I would advise everybody, like we said, to visit John's sites, follow him on X so that you can know what's going on. But yeah, go get a copy of this book if you do not have one already. And if you do, give it a reread. And, go on Kindle Unlimited and just read a couple chapters every now and then just so, John knows you're out there. And but John, thank you for your time and joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Support This Is Extreme and buy the This Is Extreme shirt. Show the world that you are part of the revolution and that you support our podcast and the history of ECW. Go to tinyurl.com/ECWpodshirt and buy yours today. All right, and we're back here on This Is Extreme. I am Dave Dynasty. Very big special thank you to John Lister for coming on and chatting with me. That was a great interview. Again, go look up John's book. Buy yourself a copy. It's a fun read. Lots of information in there, so go get one for yourself. Hey, I want to take a moment. I want to plug a couple other shows that I really, really enjoy. Of course, everybody knows all the talent, right, that out there that has as podcasts that you can listen to, right? Rob Van Dam has a show. Francine has a show, Raven has a show, Blue Meanie has a show. Everybody knows about those. I also advise that you all go out and listen to Reliving the Extreme. It's a ECW watch-along show. I've mentioned them before. It's kind of the perfect companion podcast to what I do here, right? I like to interview talent. I like to talk to talent and talk about that side of it and get their memories and so on about it. The guys over at Reliving the Extreme, Nate and Aaron, and it also includes former ECW talent Chad Austin on that show. They're doing a watch along, right? They started at the beginning. They're watching along ECW TV and events, and giving their chat analysis and everything else. They're good guys. It's a good show, and again, a perfect companion piece to what I do here. I also want to give a shout out to a kind of a new show, a new thing going on. For my buddy and former guest Chubby Dudley now has a podcast on YouTube called Chewing the Fat, and it's kind of like he's kind of interviewing a lot of talent. He's kind of starting from the beginning. A lot of the guys from the Eastern days and the Tri-State Wrestling Alliance days. He's had some good guests on there. It's a lot of fun. So go look him up on YouTube, subscribe to him, and check out his show as well. So once again, make sure you follow us on social media. Make sure you subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform. Make sure you go and order a shirt. Thank you guys for your support. Thank you for your listens. Thank you for all you do. If you're out there listening to the show, if you got a post about ECW, if you're going to post up a picture of your favorite memory, your favorite wrestler, your favorite piece of merchandise, whatever it might be, make sure you tag us in it. We'd love to see that. We want to see all the extreme action going out there on social media. But give us feedback. If you're listening to the show, let us know, man. Give us a shout out online. Just tag us in it. We love the response and the feedback. So we'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of This Is Extreme. I am Dave Dynasty. This is Extreme, the ECW History Podcast. So in 2 weeks, we'll be back. And until then, wherever you go, whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep it extreme.